the history of the Ovis, we see how the Yad Hashem protected them. Like it is stated, Lo hiniach le'ish le'oshkom, he did not allow any man to wrong them. Va'yochach aleihem melochim, and he rebuked kings concerning them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervened and he criticized Avimelech, Melech Plishtim, and he criticized Tarei, and he warned them, and he criticized Lavan, and he warned him. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu stood guard over his chosen ones and allowed nobody to wrong them. And if you look through the entire history of the others, you'll see that there were no unfortunate incidents in their lives, except one. And that was the incident of Dinah. That's the one exception. When the family of the others was wrong. Now, this matter deserves some study. Tonight, it will not be investigated as it deserves because it's only mentioned incidentally. Actually, Dina was blamed for what happened. It says, Vateitse Dina. Leroy's Bivnosaurs. Dina went out to look at the daughters of the land. Well, to go out and to look at the people of the land never has beneficial results because there's nothing good that you can see. The less you see of the people of the land, the better you are. When I was a yeshiva man in Slabotke, one Shabbos morning, I was walking before Davnin, and I stopped near the bridge between Slabotke and Kovne to see how many Jews were going to work Shabbos morning. That's the Europe, the Eastern Europe, the Lithuania. And people wonder, why did it happen? What did Hashem have against those great tzaddikim? Well, I was looking at the tzaddikim going to work Shabbos morning. And the old Mashgiach Zecheinu Levracha came along and he says, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking at people going to work. So he said, it's not good to look. I'm sure he meant more than I intend. But that's what he says. It's not good to look. And Dina went out to look, and that's why this misfortune happened. However, the Chachamim explained to us that it wasn't that simple. She didn't merely go out to look. The Chachamim say, Vateitse Dina is similar to Vateitse Leah. Her mother also went out, and she is called Yatsonis Bas Yatsonis, a goer out, the daughter of a goer-out. Ki ima ki bita, like the mother, so was the daughter. But when Leah went out, we know it was for a very big purpose. Leah went out in order that one more shevet of the Am Yisrael should come into existence. But Teitzei Leah was of the utmost importance in our history. It had results that were forever. When Leah went out and told Yaakov that he belongs to her now because ki sochias charticha, I paid for you, the results were of the greatest importance. And we have to understand that when Dina went out, she also did it for a very virtuous purpose. She went out to look at the daughters of the land, not because of idle curiosity. She was walking in the footsteps of her great ancestors. Remember? Soro Megayeres Es Hanoshin. Soro, our mother, had a function of converting women. She spoke to women. And Dina went out to see the daughters of the land, what could be done for them. That's how Dina went out, to size them up, to see what the situation is, and to understand how could you teach them the principles of the Emunah. That's what Dina went out for. And that's the question. So why is she blamed for being a Yatsonis, Bas Yatsonis, a goer out, the daughter of a goer out? The answer is, her mother, true, she went out virtuously. When Leah went out, it was an immense achievement of righteousness. But there was something that in a minute way tasted of immodesty. Now, we couldn't say that word about Leah, our mother, but something here was not entirely proper according to their great standards. To go out and to solicit Yankiv and say that I paid for you, because she wanted to have another son, she wanted another Shevet, she wanted to increase the Jewish people, that's certainly good. But the method smacked a little bit of immodesty. And that's why she's called a Yatsonis, a goer out. And therefore, when her daughter went out, also for a good purpose, well, she was criticized. Because Sora, our mother, was Megayeres Es Hanoshim, she converted women in a different way than Avraham Avinu converted men. Avraham went out to the marketplace and he accosted people and he argued with people. He did it on the street. But Sora, Megayeres Es Hanoshim, Sora converted only those noble people, the intelligentsia of the women that came to her in her home. It made a big difference. Sora didn't go out in the street. She sat in her salon, in her drawing room, in her parlor, and there came the princesses, the noble ladies, and they sat around her, the intelligentsia, and she spoke to them in the privacy of her home, because Sora didn't go out. It was against her principles to display herself. You remember when the Malachim came to Avraham and Avraham was speaking with them? It said, Sora Shema. Sora was listening. Sora always listened, not just that time. Sora was a type who wouldn't let anything go by. She always wanted to hear. She was thirsty to hear. And she was standing behind the entrance to the tent and she was listening. But she didn't show herself. She didn't come out and engage the Malachim in conversation, in bright and witty repartee, in brilliant conversation, like sometimes pious women, even Beis Yaakov women, come out and want to talk in Yirat Shemayim with men. Because this is not the way of Sora, our mother. Men talk Divrei Torah with men, and the ladies talk the words of Hashem with ladies. Because when men and ladies talk together, then it's something else. They can talk even Rambam and Sisera Torah, they can talk Zohar, but when men and women talk together, it's something entirely different. It's no longer Rambam and Zohar. And therefore, Sora Shoima, Sora was listening, but you couldn't see her. She made it her business. They used to tell me once, there was a lady who used to flirt with Musa. When he used to visit her home, so she flirted with her man by talking in Musar. And so, Sora didn't talk when men were present. Sora spoke a lot, but she spoke to women. And therefore, Dina was criticized for going out. Dina didn't go out to look at the boys of the land, no question. She went out to look at those bifinosar, only at the girls. But when you go out to look at the girls of the land, it just happens that the girls of the land have boys of the land also around them. And that's when the trouble began. And that's when a certain boy saw her, and the trouble took place. That's the one incident, the one tragedy in the history of the others. So although it may seem to us that we understand the reason why this happened, but our Chachamim give us something a little more abstruse, something that's a little more delicate, and we'll study this. The Chachamim say it was a punishment for Yaakov Avinu. It doesn't mean it wasn't a rebuke to her. Dina also was rebuked by this, but it was also a punishment to her father. Do you know why? So the Chachamim say Esav, Yaakov's brother, was in the market for a wife. Now, he had plenty of wives, but he was always in the market for another one. And as Yaakov was coming home, he had a beautiful daughter. And Yaakov was thinking that if my brother puts his eyes on my daughter Dina, I'm going to get an unwanted son-in-law. And therefore, he put Dina into a trunk. And she traveled with the baggage. But a trunk sometimes can be opened. Esav, the friendly brother, might try to look into the trunks too. So Yaakov nailed down the lid. I'm sure he put some breathing holes there. And Dina was riding in the trunk on the back of the camels. And the lid was nailed down. And this is what our sages say. Lo bi kashtole hasiyo beheta. You didn't want to marry her off permissibly. You could have married her off to Esav. Who knows? Maybe she would have had a good effect on him. Maybe he would have done teshuvah as a result of such a good wife. You didn't want to marry her off permissibly. So now you're going to get it. She's going to be taken in a forbidden way. And that's why she was seized by this Gentile boy. It was a punishment for Yaakov. Now we have to understand what was taking place. Yaakov knew Esav well. He lived with him together from the beginning. Anybody knew Esav, it was Yaakov. If Yaakov had thought that Dina could reform Esav, he would have been the first one to propose the Shidduch. He was convinced that it would be nothing but a tragedy for Dina, a ruined life for her to wed Esav. In general, when a man marries somebody's daughter, according to the Torah aspect, he is marrying her father. It may not sound romantic, but that's the truth. When you marry a daughter, you're really marrying her father. The daughter is only the excuse to be connected with the father. The Gemara says that a man should marry the daughter of a pious person, a Talmid Chochem, whatever it is. So how can he be close to a Talmid Chochem? It's a mitzvah of the Torah. Uvo Sidbok, you should cling to Hashem. How can you join Hashem? So the Chachamim said you can join Hashem by joining the sages. Get close to Chachamim. And how do you get close to sages? So one of the recommended ways is to marry the daughter of a sage. So if you want to get close to a sage, you marry his daughter, and that's only the excuse. You can't help it. So he throws a daughter in. But you really mean the father. So a daughter is a bond that joins the father-in-law with the son-in-law. And that's how it has to be. A father-in-law and a son-in-law must always feel that they are bonded. They are almost like a father and a son. And that's what you young fellas have to think. You look at the pretty face of your wife, then you look at your father-in-law's face, and you say, I didn't marry him. And sometimes it disappoints you. You look at your father, and he looks almost like your wife. Difference is, your wife has a fancy hairdo. It's almost the same face. Now, the truth is, the father-in-law is what counts. The wife counts too. But their father-in-law. Now, once Esav would have married Dinah, it means Esav would have been joined forever with Yaakov. And that's one thing Yaakov couldn't afford. You remember when Yaakov came back and Esav was so kind-hearted and he offered again and again to escort Yaakov? And Yaakov apologized with all kinds of tricks, stratagems, to get out of this honor, because he didn't want such company. The company of Esau is perilous. And therefore, to us it seems that Yaakov Avinu was fully justified in slamming down the lid and putting in the nails in that trunk. But our sages tell us that's why he was punished. He was punished because he concealed Dinah from Esau. This we have to understand. I'll tell you what they said in Slabodka on this kasha. In Slabodka they said that Yaakov was fully justified. There's no criticism at all. He had no alternative. He was forced to conceal Dinah from Esau. But when he was putting in the nails and banging them in, he hit them in with too much force. I'll explain that. A nail, you have to hit in. It's not butter. You have to bang it into wood. But it depends how much you put into it of your feelings. And this is what the Mefarshim of Slabodka said. The Mefarshim means the people, the yeshiva man, explained. This is what the teachers meant when they said that. Yankee, when he was banging in the nails, he should have wept bitter tears. He should have said, if I could have married off my daughter to my brother, it would have been the happiest day in my life, if my brother would have been worthy. But the poor fellow forsook the straight path, and now it's impossible for me to allow this to take place. And every time he banged a nail, he should have said, ouch, it's like a nail in my heart. So the nails, he had to bang. He had to conceal his daughter. But he should have done it with sadness, with sorrow, that he was forced to do it. But as all great things, there's a commentary, and there's a commentary on the commentary. You already heard a commentary on the commentary. Now a third, the truth is Yaakov did grieve. Yaakov was sorry. There's no question that Yaakov shed bitter tears when he had to do this. Only, what was the criticism on him? And why was he punished? Because he didn't shed enough tears. And now we'll go back and review. The sages say Yaakov was punished because he concealed Dinah. But we ask, Dinah had to be concealed? And the answer is, because he banged in the nails with too much venom. But the kasha is, he has to bang in the nails with kayach. He has to bang in with the force. So the answer is, he should have wept. Then the kasha is, he surely did weep. When Yaakov banged in the nails without weeping that his brother wasn't worthy, the answer is, he wept. But in heaven, they counted his tears. They weren't enough. Now, whether you accept this or not, you're not really able to accept anything that you hear here. But the idea is, the very important lesson that we're going to discuss tonight. But before we broach the lesson, we're going to quote one more example from the Gemara and Masechta Yuma, and then we'll see what's the common denominator of both stories. In Masechta Yuma, a tragic incident is related. In the olden days, when the time came in the morning to allocate, to distribute the mitzvos of the service in the Beis HaMikdash, they did not throw lots, didn't cast lots. Casting a lot means that from heaven they're giving you a certain mitzvah, certain schutz, certain merit. You should do this in this form of the service. No, in the olden days, they didn't want to cast lots. They wanted you to earn it. And how did you earn it? There was an official of the Kehanim, and the official gave a signal, and everybody ran to see who would get there first. And the man whose heart was most in it, that's the theory, the man whose heart was most earnest, so his feet moved the fastest. In general, it's a pretty good indication They weren't running for money. They're running for a mitzvah. So the one who ran fastest, it showed that his heart was most interested. And when the time came, therefore, for Trumas Hadesh, and Trumas Hadesh was the first mitzvah in the morning. It was still somewhat dark. Imagine a picture now. The Beit HaMikdash is full of people. Kohanim are standing, and they're waiting for the signal. The signal is given as a rush. Now, some Kohanim were up all night waiting for this. They didn't sleep, because this is very early in the morning, before dawn. And they were on edge. Their hearts were burning with a desire, at least once, to seize a mitzvah. There are so many Kohanim, and few mitzvahs to be done. And this man maybe came from the other end of Eretz Yisrael. He had walked, and all night he hadn't slept, and in the morning he was standing ready, and the signal was given, so he ran. His feet were weary. He had traveled to Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim, but his heart was pumping him, and he ran with all of his kochos, and he thought he'll surely get it. And he saw another one, a young Kohen, was overtaking him and was going faster and forging ahead. So his heart became so full of bitterness. He came especially from the other end of Eretz Yisrael for this mitzvah. He had been all up all night, and now is running with all of his koyach, and this young fellow is forging ahead. So he lost control. He was running with a knife. The Kohanim had knives that he needed, and he took that knife, and he became berserk, and he plunged it into the heart of his opponent. And now this young Kohen is rolling in his blood, and the whole Azorah is thunderstruck. Such a thing never happened. And they come running together from all sides. Now among those who come running is the father of the dying youth. And the father runs to the scene, and he falls on his knees, and he listens to see if the son's heart is still palpitating. And the father arrives and announces to everybody. He says, "Don't fear," he says, "nothing to fear. My son is still alive," means he's dying, but he's still alive, "and nothing has become tame yet. He hadn't rendered unclean anything yet." So the people standing around were taking it back. Didn't expect this. A father, his son is dying. His lifeblood is gushing from his heart. And the father is announcing with happiness, "There's nothing to worry about. Nothing has become tame. If you'll take him out right away, he'll die outside, and the Azorah, the courtyard, will remain pure." Now this incident was not allowed to pass over. So the sages got together in the following generations, and they studied this incident. Iboyelehu, and they asked the following questions. Iboyelehu Newman, and they asked, "Is it because of Taharas Kalim, the purity of Kalim, was so important to them, although he was a father, and his heart was bleeding for his son? But the ideal, the love of the sanctuary was so great that it overcame his natural feelings, because his true natural feelings were Avas Hashem. He loved HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he loved his sanctuary. Like David said, 'Mo'ahavti v'kon beisecho,' how I love the place where your house is. I love it." And he loved it with all his heart. So it's not because he was remiss in his affection as a father. It was because their love for the sanctuary was so great. Or maybe, no, the Gemara says, maybe their love for the sanctuary was not so great, but his horror at bloodshed wasn't great. Maybe he loved the sanctuary normally, but he wasn't too much interested in the fact that his son was dying. It didn't impress him. He had a queer question. A father sees his son passing out, So we suspect that maybe he doesn't love his son enough? And that's the question in the Gemara. Now, whatever the Gemara answers, I'll let you wait until you learn a Sifta Yuma. The Gemara says it better than I could say it. But what do we see from here? We see a queer thing. There is no question that the father was dumbfounded. The father was stricken when he saw his son about to die. He's a father. Any father. Even Patrick, who kicked his son out into the street. He deserved it. A bump. And as his son ran into the street, threatening, when he come back that night, he'll kill the old man. And as the boy walked into the street, a car bumped into him and finished him off. The old man ran out in the street and fall on his knees and kiss his son and sob with bitter tears. No question about it. No question about it. It's natural for a father to react that way. And suppose the son wasn't a bum? Suppose the son was a tzaddik and a Talmid Chochem and a Kodosh and one of the Kehanim? There's no question that the father's heart was torn to pieces. His heart was bleeding when he saw his son lying there. And still the Gemara asks, maybe it's not because he loved the sanctuary so much. Maybe because he didn't love his son enough. That's a puzzling thing. And the answer is that in heaven, a man's thoughts are measured with degrees. Just as in the case of Yaakov, who surely wept that he had to deny his daughter to Esau, and he wept copiously. But in heaven, they measured, and they said, it's not enough. For a man like Yaakov, it's not enough. Now that's a big kiddush to us. We would think it's enough if you weep. No. The Torah teaches a great man should weep more and more. It's not enough. And therefore our sages in Masechta Yuma, when they measured the tears of this father, they said maybe it's not enough. It could be he wasn't so much in love with the sanctuary. He certainly loved his son, but it could be he was remiss. It wasn't enough. Maybe had he been more excited over his son, he wouldn't have thought about the purity of the sanctuary. And we'll leave this question to the sages to debate. For our purposes, that's enough. And now we're going to hear what the subject is all about. We're going to read a quotation from the Chovetz Chabad on this subject. It's in Shaar Yichud HaMaaseh. Now this section, Yichud HaMaaseh, is where the Chovetz Chabad concentrates on a very important subject, and that is the subject of purity of thought. Now, purity of thought doesn't sound like much of a subject. Or you might think it means something else. And here's what he says about this subject. On this subject. I'll tell you what we'll do then. We'll go back, spend a few more minutes, then we'll take a question, anything. Perek Shishi in Yichud HaMaaseh. Now pay attention. Roi lecha shelo tisaleim lifkeid machshav techobar ayoneh. It's important not to neglect to examine your thoughts and the inner motives of your mind. To examine your inner motives. Ki roiv ha-hefsed ve-ha-tikun ve-maisim lo yekim machmosim. When you do acts, in most cases, your acts are valued only according to the amount of intent that accompanies them. Now that's a very important statement. The value of your act, the virtue of your act, depends on how much intent you invested in it. And sometimes and beautiful deeds is rendered meaningless by the lack of proper intent. Now, people tend to overlook this because we live with externalities and we're satisfied with doing things in a way where the acts seem to us virtuous. So even when the act is perfectly correct, nevertheless, in heaven, a great deal depends on the inner motivation. We'll give an example. When our forefathers received the Torah, we know there was very great enthusiasm. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu praised them greatly for this enthusiasm. Now, after some time passed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the signal, and they were commanded to set forth on their travels. And this you know, that their travels were al pi Hashem. They didn't travel. They didn't set out whenever they desired. Al pi Hashem Yisu, al pi Hashem Yachnu. They started out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the order, and they stopped and made camp when he gave the order. Now it states, Vayisiu mehar chorei. They journeyed away from Har Sinai. Just before that, now, there's a little parsha right next to that, Vayhi b'nisaya ha'or and Vayomer Moshe. And this little parsha is introduced in the Torah. If you look in the Sefer Torah, you see an upside down nun before it and an upside down nun after it. Now, why do you have such a queer thing, an upside down nun before and after these few words? Those words that you say when you take out the Sefer Torah. So the Gemara explains that this parsha doesn't belong here. It was taken from someplace else, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu ordered it to be written here for a purpose. What was the purpose? The two nuns, the upside down nuns, are written there to show that this parsha does not belong here. So why was it put in where it doesn't belong? Lehafsik bein puranis lupuranis. To make a division between one misfortune and another misfortune. There were two misfortunes. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want us, while we're hearing Kriyas HaTorah, we might become so excited, one misfortune, another misfortune, so he might feel faint, might run out to get some fresh air and miss Kriyas HaTorah. And therefore they put in between a little rest, Vayhi bin Sa'ara, to let us recuperate from the effects of the first misfortune before we enter the second misfortune. Now, what's the second misfortune? Vayhi hom ki mis eidonim. That's the misfortune when the people complained that they weren't getting good enough service in the Midbar. They complained that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't feeding them well enough. So something happened. It was a misfortune. They were punished for that. That we understand. What was the misfortune before? The misfortune before was Vayisu mehar cheirev. They departed from Har Cheirev. They parted from Mount Sinai. So what's the misfortune? So the Gemara tells us Ketinok haboreach mebeis haseifa, like a boy going home from the yeshiva. That's a young boy. He's 13 or 14. And yeshiva's over for the day. So he skips out of the door. His rebbe is standing by the door and says, are you so happy to leave us? The boy says, no, I'm not happy. But he skips anyhow. So, when they left Har Sinai, they left with happiness. Now the question is, what do you want of them? They didn't leave because they wanted to. Al pi Hashem Yisu. They were commanded to leave. They couldn't stay. Imagine, here's a fellow telling his teacher, no, I'm sorry to leave. I want to be here all day long. The janitor comes along, never mind, he says. I have to lock up. You have to leave the building. and the janitor pushes the boy out. What do you expect the boy to do? Go back and fight with the janitor? And the guy called the Baruch himself tells the boy, you have to leave. He says, Al Pi Hashem Yisa, you have to leave Har Sinai. And they left. And there's no question they left with sadness. There's no question they regretted to leave this great place. Har Sinai! That's the place of our greatness. Never again did any nation experience such a greatness. There's no question they left with regret. But the answer is they didn't leave with enough regrets. They should have been still more sad. In the olden days, when a man died without children, his wife went to Yibum. She was taken as wife by his brother. In case he didn't agree, so he had to give chalitza. Now today, we don't permit Yibum anymore. Today we say mitzvahs chalitza koidemes le mitzvahs Yibum. We tell him, you must give chalitza and you shouldn't marry her. But in the olden days, it was mitzvahs Yibum koidemes le mitzvahs chalitza. We always urged him to do the mitzvah of taking her as his wife. That was preferable. Now the question is, what changed? What happened that they discontinued Yibum? Chalitza, you must have, of course. Why did they stop Yibum? Now listen to a queer thing the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Borishoino shehoyum is kavlin l'shem mitzvah. In the olden days, when a man took his brother's widow, his intent was a sham mitzvah. But now, the intent is not always for a mitzvah. He might want her as a wife. And it seems that he's taking his brother's wife, his brother's widow, and he's transgressing an Isar Koras. To take a brother's widow, let's say a brother died with children, anybody, if any of the brothers married a widow, is doing a very severe sin. Is doing a very severe sin. To marry a brother's widow when the brother left children is a severe sin, like marrying your own sister. And therefore, when people stopped being as pure as they were in the ancient times, and therefore sometimes he took his brother's widow, not l'shem mitzvah, nimso poigeya bel. It looked like he is taking a forbidden woman. Now this is not so easy to understand, because the Torah says she's permitted to him. Who cares what he is thinking? The truth is she is permitted to him. His intent doesn't change things. A man who dies without children, his wife is muta to his brother. And still they discontinued it because it looks like pergeya be'erva. What do we learn from this? We learn the principle that even though a thing is fully permissible, but if the intent is not kosher, it makes the act a different kind of an act. Now that's a startling statement. And therefore, the Chavis Halavadis takes our time to tell us it's of the utmost importance whenever you do anything to examine your motives. Otherwise, you may chalila be losing the entire virtue of this mitzvah. And that is what the Chavis HaDavos warns. Al kein yesh lecho ochi lishtadel lihiyois kol ma'asecha miyuchodim labere. That's why it's important at all times to examine one's thoughts and see how much of Hashem is in his mind when he's doing it. Hear that? When you put on tefillin, it's so important to keep in mind not only that the tefillin should be kosher in the ribua and kosher in shachrus and kosher in parshias, there are very many things you have to be aware of in order to have good tefillin. But in addition to everything else, this people will tell you, it may not be so. They'll tell you that this is not important. But that's why we came here tonight to listen. Rabbi said to his great disciples in his yeshiva, Rabbi said, "Bimotusi minayfi, I beg of you, lo tirsi tarti gehenem. You shouldn't inherit gehenem twice." As Rabbi said. How can you get gehenem twice? One gehenem is if you suffer in this world for a good purpose, but you're suffering. It's like a gehenna. But it wouldn't be a gehenna if you knew it's for a good purpose. But the other gehenna is when he comes to the next world and they tell him there's nothing but gehenna because his motives were not pure. Now this is something that's almost unheard of today. Nobody speaks of it. We can't help it today because anybody does things, we embrace him. Even though his motives are rotten, we're so happy that he should keep mitzvot, we're not going to examine his motives. That's for us. We're looking for allies. Anybody that come into us, we say, "Achino ati, our brother." Who cares what your motives are? But in heaven, it's not so. In heaven, motives are most important. And therefore, when you take your kashar tefillin and you put them on, it's of the utmost importance to keep in mind what you're doing. And even if you'll say something before you put on the tefillin, that helps, by the way. But there needs also some thought. People give tremendous amounts of money for charity. But in very many cases, it's done only to please somebody else. Not because they are motivated by a desire to serve Hashem. They can't refuse. You know how much money goes down the drain because of that? Now I say down the drain. HaKadosh Baruch Hu eina mekapeach shchar kol belya. He doesn't take away rewards from anyone. He'll pay that man too. But it's nothing compared to the greatness of taking money and giving for something that your own seichel, your own conscience tells you that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. When a mother feeds her child, if she does it like the lady next door does it, Mrs. Dominic also feeds her child, Mrs. Jones also feeds her child with compassion. So if Mrs. Levine and Mrs. Cohen also do the same, so what is their greatness? When a Jewish woman will feed a child because she is an emissary of the one who is poseach es yodecha umasbia lechol chai rotzo, he opens up his hand and he feeds, he satiates all the living. So a mother opens up her hand and she feels that her hand is the hand of Hashem. You know what that means? She has taken a simple act that everybody does, and she has elevated it into one of the great forms of service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Imagine a butcher. A butcher standing behind the counter is passing meat out to customers. You know that butcher is wasting his life? All he gets is money. If he would stand behind the counter and think, let Jews enjoy life. Let him have a good piece of meat. I was talking today to a man at a chain of stores, a delicatessen chain, and he was telling me how he's working hard to keep it kosher. He wants high standards of kosher. I said, that's good. But you should keep in mind also, you're giving many Orthodox Jews a good time. You know what a big thing it is to make Orthodox Jews happy? Eating salami and eating barbecue chicken. You're giving a good time to many Jews. A baker, when he hands out bread over the counter, it could be noisein lechem lechol bosor kilo elam chazda. Isn't that a pity? I once spoke to a dentist about that. It looked to me, when I said this, I said, "You're You're helping mankind. Think about that. If you would add the thought that you're serving the Almighty, He heals all flesh, and you're serving Him by healing people. Just think how you'll transform your career into a career of serving Hashem, your emissary of Hashem. He looked at me with such intelligence as this wall looks at me. I tried it again, at other visits, nothing went in. Needs a great deal of training to perceive this. When a father slaves all the week in the factory, in his office, he's wasting his life. If he would add a little bit of thought, I'm doing this in order to raise up a generation of Shomrei Torah. And let him think about it as frequently as he can. When he opens up the office in the morning, he opens up his store in the morning, he thinks that. And a couple of times during the day to refresh his memory. Now people might think this is superfluous. Who needs it? As long as you're doing the right deeds. But we are learning now that the deeds are transformed by the intent. The intent is the heart of the deed. And the more heart in it, the more powerful, the more potent, and more precious the deed becomes. When you hand a quarter to a poor man, and you do it because you can't refuse, you're embarrassed. Do you know that he's robbing you? It's a hold up. If you'd give him instead of a quarter, he asked for a quarter. That cost you, you asked for a quarter. You wouldn't have done it. You see him coming, so you try to walk around the corner fast. But another one comes, the other side, you're stuck. It's a hold up. Cost you, you give him a quarter. Of course, if you give him 26 cents, that extra penny is worth more than, not the quarter, worth more than many dollars. That one penny more. And the quarter, that's all you have. And you'll put in a little thought, I'm giving it to him because Elokeichem Ohev Aniyim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, loves the poor, and therefore I am his emissary. You're transforming the deed. Now this is a subject that's so important that we should go on for hours quoting examples how this should be applied. Parents. When a man gets married, a woman gets married, if they had in mind the future generations, you know what a big reward they would have? Instead of merely marrying her because he wants a wife and she wants a husband, and children will come, naturally, they're Orthodox people, they'll have a lot of children. But the children usually come as accidents. Isn't that a tragedy? Suppose that children, I'm not talking now about the number of children. Let's say you'll have a lot of children anyhow. But why should they have a lot of accidents? Why shouldn't each case be the result of a prayer? The result of a noble intent. He marries because he wants a generation of Avdei Hashem. Of course, he couldn't tell it to a girl because she'll feel that it's robbing her of romance. But in their hearts, that's going to transform this act. Everything in life is different. Everything becomes ennobled. Otherwise, our lives are wasted. We're just machines. We're just cogs in a machine like the Gentiles are working. All over the world, people are working and people are living and supporting children and marrying off children. Italians also want nachas from children. But when Jews want nachas from children, not because of selfish motives. Now, you can't help being selfish. But if in addition to the selfish motive, you're able to add one more thought, and that's what the Chevah Salavas is telling us. It's of the utmost importance to add intent to what you're doing. And tonight when you go home, if you didn't eat, and you're going to have supper tonight, as you sit down at the table, wouldn't be a bad idea not to rely just on your thoughts, but say with your mouth, I'm going to eat now in order to make my body healthy. I should be able to serve Hashem. If you'll start doing that from now on, don't let your mother hear you. She'll think that something happened. But try to take a psychiatrist. That's what mothers do when they see the boy is getting drunk. But say it quietly under your palm. If you say it at every meal, Hinini oichel, kidei lahavres esaguf, kidei shuucha alavides Hashem. Now Rambam adds, Rambam says more than that. The Rambam says, kidei lodas es Hashem. The Rambam says that in order to know Hashem. The question, why does the Rambam forsake the words in order to serve Hashem? And the Rambam says, in order to know Hashem. It's a queer thing. And he says it three times. In Hilchos Deos, three times the Rambam says that you have to eat and take care of your health in order to know Hashem. Hear the question? Why does he know to serve Hashem? The answer is, the Rambam also believes in serving Hashem. But the highest form of serving Hashem is knowing Hashem, learning, thinking about Hashem, Torah. When you learn, your mind expands and you come closer. You know Hashem. Of all forms of service, that's the greatest. So if you ate supper before with the intent of coming here to the lecture, so you ate in order to come a little closer to Hashem. If you leave tonight in order that tomorrow you'll make more progress and come closer, that's the highest of all motives. If we will do this, we will be fulfilling what the Rambam says. The Rambam makes a comment when it says in Pirkei Avos, "V'chol ma'asecha yiyu l'shem shemayim," all your deeds should be for the sake of heaven. The Rambam says it's a remarkable statement. Now, when we learn it, we don't see anything remarkable. Certainly, everything should be done l'shem shemayim. The Rambam is nispoil from this statement. He's excited over this statement. Because that statement, that's the heart of our lives. If you have a factory and you employ Jews and your intention is you want to give Jews paranosa, you know what he's doing? Instead of being a man that manufactures materials in order to make money, you're manufacturing lives. You're manufacturing families. These Jews who work under you are making a living and having children and bringing them up because of you. So you say, well, what difference does it make? They're doing it anyhow. No! The deed becomes worthless if it's robbed of the intent. Now imagine a man with a big factory and he has 200 Jewish workers. And his intent is, should be 200 Jewish families. And 200 sets of parents raising children, and that's my intent. And now you say, well, he's a faker, he's not doing it for them, he wants to make money, only the workers he needs in order to help them make money. No, it's a mistake. You can add an intent even though it's not your sole intent. I once spoke about this. It says you should eat l'shem shemayim. So there's once a tzaddik who tried to do it. So he never chewed his food. He swallowed whole pieces until finally he became ill and the doctor told him to stop. Do you know why? He became ill. He was being punished. Not supposed to swallow food. You think Hashem wants you to swallow food without enjoying it in order to eat l'shem shemayim? That's what he thought. He was a young man. He said, how can I eat for the sake of heaven if I enjoy it? So I'll swallow whole pieces without chewing it, so I won't enjoy it. It'll be l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. I'm only eating for the sake of heaven. He was punished, became sick. The sake of heaven means you should sink your teeth into that food and enjoy it. Let the saliva run, let the stomach juices run. Enjoy it. Go to town. Doesn't mean you have to spend money, but a piece of bread, a glass of water, enjoy it. Doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy it, but while you're enjoying it, add the intent that you're doing it to be healthy in order to serve Hashem. A man can marry a pretty wife, doesn't have to take the ugliest wife he can find and say, I'm marrying only Shem Shemayim. No! He can marry a pretty girl, only he adds the intent. He adds. It's a big mistake people make pshat. You add the intent to Shem Shemayim. You can enjoy life. You can be happy. You can make a lot of money. Nothing wrong. What do you find in the Gemara? Any place that is wrong to make money? It's wrong to be rich. It's wrong to be happy. It's a fundamental error to think it's wrong. But while you're doing it, you shouldn't waste your life. Because even if you are a poor shoe repairer and you have no machines, you just have a form between your knees, and you put an old torn shoe on that, and you fix a heel, and you get for 50 cents profit, it's a very small operator. If you don't do the Shem Shemayim, your life is also wasted. So you might as well be a shoe manufacturer and be a rich man. But if you'll add the kavon of Hashem Shemayim, you'd like mankind to wear shoes. Isn't that a great thing? Hashem also wants people to wear shoes. You know that? I'll prove it to you. Because you make shoes grow on the backs of cows. How do shoes grow on the backs of cows? If a cow ate leather, so therefore it would produce leather. But a cow eats grass and water and nothing else, and it produces leather. The skin of the cow is the result of what it eats. Where does a cow's skin come from? From its mother? But the mother also only ate grass and drank water. So all leather is nothing but grass and water transformed, metamorphosed into leather. Ask any chemist, they'll tell you that. We are not able to take grass and water and make it into leather. But a cow can do it. It's a miracle. A cow has all the enzymes that enable it to take grass and water and change it into the leather. Now that miracle was made by the Bohele, the Creator. Why did he make such a miracle? He just wanted for the cow. So the cow should walk around during its lifetime. She's in soft leather. No, he didn't make it for the cows. Cows are not that important. He put leather on the cow that eventually it should be transformed into soles of shoes. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is busy providing shoes for mankind. And if you do the same, let's say that's your business. You're in Brockton at a big factory. You're manufacturing shoes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, this man would be my emissary if he intended it. But the great tragedy is, he's thinking only about his own money. He lost a glorious opportunity. And so, if you have a chain of bargain stores, if you have a big factory that produces radios, whatever you do in life, if you add a kavona, an intent, you could transform all of this. Take all of the pebbles and all of the earth, and you would transform it into gold. And that's this great lesson that the Chavos Halvavos emphasizes for us. Now, questions on any subject at all. But brief, very short. Yaakov loved Rachel. So this gentleman asked, so you see romance? But as was explained, when Yaakov gave Rachel a kiss, he wept. Now, nobody weeps because of romance. The weeping is a sign that the kiss was a neshika, not of tiflus, not of romance. It was a neshika of kurva, of relationship, kinship. And I explained that last week, and that's enough of that subject. He wept because he hadn't seen his kin for a long time, and now he saw somebody from his family. So he gave her a kiss. Yankee was already a very old man in the 80s, and she was a little girl. He gave her a kiss. It was a relative of his. Of course, today, even that we don't do, but in those great days, it was permissible. And he wept, and the sages tell us the weeping was a sign that it wasn't a kiss of romance. Any other questions? How much is the average tzedakah yeshiva bacher should give? Depends how much allowance his parents give him. Should one say Hallel on Yom HaTzmoyes? If yes, with or without a Beracha? The first question is, should you say Hallel on Columbus Day? When Columbus discovered America, it was a great blessing for the Jewish people. It was a preparation for one of the greatest Jewish communities in history. And therefore, next Columbus Day, when they're marching in the street, so take your mazel, your siddur, and go out If you feel moved to say Hallel, be careful not to say with the Baracha. And on the fifth of Iyar, don't say it even without a Baracha. Because the fifth of Iyar is not a day of happiness. And I'll tell that to you some other day. But for the time being, I answered the question. Any questions for the man? We'll just give you opportunity. What is the symbolic interpretation of Tumo? Uncleanliness. We have to know that Tumo is a sign of Harchoko. HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes things unclean when he wants mankind to keep away from them. When he makes a dead body unclean, it's because he wants people to keep away from it. And what's the reason? Because a dead body causes sadness. And Hashem does not want us to be sad. And that's why he wants it to be buried as soon as possible. Because you see a dead body disintegrating, it's a disgrace to mankind's dignity. And it causes sadness. And that's why not only there are laws of uncleanliness, I'm going to tell you something that's a very important principle. Everything in nature that has an offensive odor is given that odor as a warning by Hashem to keep away from it. Unless it's something that's unnaturally flavored. But naturally, all harmful things have bad odors. And uncleanliness means keep away. And the same is a mitzorah, a leper, he's unclean because Hashem wants people to keep away from him. Any other questions from the men? Yes.
There are certain laws which state where an uncle can't marry a niece. Is there any halacha in the Chumash or Gemara on that?
An uncle can marry a niece. A man cannot marry his aunt. An aunt is forbidden to marry. But an uncle can marry a niece, and not only can marry, but it's considered a virtuous thing. He's recommended to marry Bas Achoisa, his sister's daughter, because he'll love his wife more because she's his sister's daughter. And some say it refers to his brother's daughter too. But a sister's daughter is recommended. It's only forbidden to marry an aunt. That's all. This young man is faced by a question: should he go to college where he thinks that he could thereby become equipped to do great things, important things? So I must tell you, my friend, that I am not competent to give you any answer. It's a question that you have to go to your own rebbes or people who know you well and discuss it at length. This is a question that's too important for me to say anything privately, publicly. However, this I can tell you. One of the biggest achievements in life, not only for yourself, but for the entire Jewish people and for the world, is when a young man makes out of himself a Talmid Chacham. Now, don't think it's selfish. If you can transform yourself from a lump of meat, that's what human beings are, an ordinary nobody, in the course of years, and don't be in a hurry, if by the age of 60 you become a Talmid Chacham, then you are conferring upon the world an inestimable benefit. We have plenty of accountants. Of course, taxes are going up and up, and accounting is going to become more and more lucrative. But the Jewish nation is not benefiting by accountants. Of course, we like to have fine accountants around. But you'll do more for the Jewish people if you'll become a Talmid Chacham. You know, when Hillel was being tested, two men made a wager once that they can make him angry. And they wagered 400 zuz. So one said, I'll bet you 400 zuz that you can't make Hillel angry. So he went. You know the story. It was Erev Shabbat, and Hillel was sitting in his bathtub, and a man banged on the door and said, where is Hillel? Hillel went out of his bath. A man was knocking on the door. He didn't ignore him. He went out, and he wrapped himself around with a dignified garment, and he said to the man, what is it I can do for you? and the man asked him foolish questions. Hillel went back again. The man knocked again on the door. Finally, the man said to Hillel, if you are Hillel, then there shouldn't be many like you. And Hillel said, why, my son? And the man said, because I lost 400 Jews because of you. So Hillel said, my son, he said, listen to what Hillel said, my son, he said, it's worth that you should lose 400 Jews and 400 Jews more, and Hillel shouldn't become angry. What did he say? Hillel said, my son, it's worth 800 Jews for you that there should be a man among the Jewish people that doesn't get angry. It doesn't mean only for you. Entire Jewish nation is $800 a head richer when you have somebody good in our people. One good man is the wealth of the nation. It's riches for us, and you're supplying the riches. So if you learn Torah and Yirat Shemayim, you learn character, you learn good manners, you learn mitzvot, you learn how to daven with heart, you learn to do all the things that make you a perfect example of a man, then you are doing for your people the greatest that you can do. A question here. Should you fight openly against Zionists and other evil men, or should you merely ignore and avoid them? Whether you should fight against anybody or ignore them, that depends on the circumstance. This is a question this young lady, I'm sure it's a young lady, asked. I cannot tell you whether you should fight or ignore. That's too general a question. And whom you should fight or ignore, I also wouldn't tell you. But one thing I can tell you is, young lady, you better learn not to fight with your husband. And if you think it's superfluous, let me tell you, that's the first thing you have to learn. While you worry about fighting against other people, other evil men, there's one evil man, you have to get along with him. You know, if it were up to me, I would institute in all the girls' schools, in all the seminaries, courses for success in marriage. And there isn't one. Because I used to speak to girls frequently. When I brought up the subject of studying for success in marriage, they thought it a waste of time. They want to hear, the good girls want to hear about the Torah, what the Malbim says, what the Klei Yaakov said. It's wonderful. But the thing that's most necessary is, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say on the subject of living with another person in the same house? You weren't trained for it. All your life you were trained up till the age of 18 or whatever it is. You were trained by your parents. Whatever you said, they said, yes, yes. If you stamped your foot, they became frightened. And they didn't do what you want. You ran into your room and slammed the door. And your mother got on her knees and brought supper to you on her knees. And finally, you said, no, no, go away. When your mother went back to sleep, you went out and sneaked out and ate up the whole thing. And so you marry a man who is the same thing in his house. Now two such people have to live together. And that's why I say, of all questions, whom should you learn to fight against? You should learn how to not fight with your husband. Now, before we have all the questions of the ladies, we'll give the men a couple of chances. Time is almost up. All right, we'll listen to the ladies then. I see the men are satisfied with everything. Doesn't leprosy have the same spiritual connotation as it did during the time of Moshe and Miriam, since the disease still exists today? Question is, does leprosy today have the same significance as it did in ancient times? And the answer is, the great Sfarim say that no. Leprosy is a disease, but in ancient times, when the Shekhinah rested on Yisrael, leprosy was a manifestation of the Ratzon Hashem in a more open way than mere Yisurim. Why did the Kehanim feel it was worth taking a chance, trying to be Mekayim and Mitzvah? There was a Safek if they could have spent their time learning. Now that's a question that applies to all of us. Should we seek mitzvahs, or should we seek only learning? Now, call Toho Emet, Ainli Ella Torah. Somebody says, I have nothing but Torah, I feel a Torah Emet. Doesn't even have Torah. We have to realize that the Torah is given to us on condition. And it's not called Torah unless it's al manas lasis, on condition to do. If a man learns without the intent of doing, it's not called Torah. Now, it doesn't mean he has to spend his life doing, because learning is one of the most important forms of doing. But he has to, from time to time, desire to do. You know, the Vilna Goyen, Zecheinu Levracha, he learned day and night. Day and night. In the daytime, he closed his shutters, and he learned by the light of a candle. This man, on Yom Kippur, he put his talis over his head and was confessing his sins. So his little son wanted to hear the father's sins. Nowadays, it'd be too dangerous. But in those days, he tried it. So the little boy stuck his head under the father's talis, and he testifies his father was weeping bitterly. He recalled a moment, a minute, on putting it wasted from learning Torah. Another minute on the Simchas Torah. You remember minutes. A couple of minutes during the year, the girl was saying vidui. He confessed his sin for not learning those minutes in the year. That's what their son heard his father say vidui under the talis. But you know, the girl married off so many poor girls from his efforts. The girl collected money for Achnosis College and married off very many poor girls. And so our great men don't try to hide behind the shield of Torah. They don't hide behind the Sefer, but they look for mitzvahs too. Now, exactly how much, that's something else I cannot tell you on one foot. But there's no question, Rabbi Akiva was a Gabbai Tzedakah. Hillel was a Gabbai Tzedakah. Rabban Gamliel was Avi and Shel Yisraelim. The Beis Din always took care of the needy. And therefore, Torah always has to go together with mitzvahs. I had said before that it's important for a man to choose a girl whose father is something special. What about the Baal Tshuva girls? Are they destined to be denied a good shidduch? I want to tell you something. The Baal Tshuva girls are the best. A Baal Tshuva girl is a flaming idealist. She came in under her own power. Now somebody said a joke. It's only a joke. He said, marry a Bas Talmid Chacham. Sometimes the Bas herself is a Talmid Chacham. A very good wife is important. But suppose you have two. One is, both are very good. Equally good. And one is a daughter of a Talmid Chacham. Then, of course, you know what to choose. If there was a show on television about the Lubavitcher, would you watch it? I couldn't, because I don't have one. Any more questions before we adjourn? No question among the men? I think that's satisfied with the ladies' questions. Here's a good question for the last minute before we adjourn. Why did Hashem let 6 million people get killed in Germany? Please answer. I'll be happy to answer. But this needs a longer time than that, what remains. The subject I'll be happy to speak about. There's a lot to explain. The whole world is full of misinformation. Holocaust, Schmolocaust, specialists. Here's a whole conference on the Holocaust. People sitting without hats. Eichleit Treifes, Mechalalei Shabbat. And they're sitting, these scientists, and they're studying the Holocaust. They're the ones who brought the Holocaust. The whole business is so confused, so far.
מגוון שיעורי כל הלשון נמסרים על ידי מגדי שיעורים ורבנים המשקיעים מזמנם וכוחם ללמד לרבים. אם ברצונכם וביכולתכם לסייע ולתמוך במגדי השיעורים ובמוסדות התורה שבאחריותם, תוכלו ליצור קשר ישיר עם הרבנים. לקבלת פרטי מגדי השיעורים ניתן לפנות למשרדי כל הלשון בטלפון 02-581-6622 או בכתובת דואר אלקטרוני lstrudel@hl.com